found the number one internet site for irreverent, cool, and entertaining talk programming. It's LA Talk Radio. We say what we want.
You're listening to the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com. The Maria Sanchez Show, a conversation, not a confrontation, on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com.
Good morning. This is Maria Sanchez, and welcome to the Maria Sanchez Show, heard here weekdays live at latalkradio.com. You can download free apps to get us mobile on your iPhone or your Android, and of course at your computer, and also on demand later in the day. We post the podcasts to MariaSanchezShow.com, TheMariaSanchezShow.com, and LATalkRadio.com, so you don't have any excuse for missing us. Now, we've got a very interesting program this morning before we get to some of the top local news. One is that May is the Celiac Awareness Month, and so we have a representative, the major communicator from the National Foundation for Celiac Awareness, visiting with us later on in the program, and it's a word that you may have been hearing, and we're going to speak with her about what it's all about. Gluten comes into play. And also, we have an endocrinologist at the Mayo Graduate School of Medicine that's going to be weighing in on a study that his quote is, "The chair is out to kill us, the insidious nature of sitting, and what we can do about that." But in the news tonight, and some great, we try and focus on some good, as much good news as possible. So here we have charities are seeing an influx of aid in the tornado's wake at Moore, Oklahoma. And tonight, Blake Shelton is headlining a telethon. It's going to be televised live on NBC at 9 o'clock Eastern Time. Of course, he's a judge on NBC's The Voice. It's going to be taking place at the Chesapeake Energy Arena in downtown Oklahoma City. The telethon is called Healing in the Heartland Relief Benefit Concert. Performers are scheduled to include Oklahoma native headliner Blake Shelton and his Grammy Award-winning wife, Miranda Lambert, as well as Oklahoma natives Vince Gill and Reba McEntire. And also set to perform are Usher, Darius Rucker, and Rascal Flatts. So good for them for giving their time. Now, unlike other telethons in the past where the monies have been going to the American Red Cross, this time the money is going directly to the United Way of Central Oklahoma Tornadoes Relief Fund. And they're going to distribute the funding to their partner agencies who are engaged in helping in relief and recovery efforts. So the Salvation Army reported yesterday afternoon that it's already raised more than $5 million in monetary donations as well as in in-kind food donations from many corporations. And they're saying the Salvation Army, and along with the American Red Cross, does, and I've mentioned before, I'm a volunteer spokesperson for the American Red Cross, have been in that capacity since 2008, that giving money is the best way to help. What they do is the money allows them flexibility. They spend it locally to help energize the local economy and to spend it on items that they need. The problem with clothing, for example, which is of help, obviously, because if people don't have anything and they need something, but it's with the logistics, getting it there and where to store it and warehouse it and all that sort of thing. Whereas cold hard cash, there's not an issue of that. So in another story that we mentioned yesterday that was actually met with some skepticism because I posted it on Facebook. If you haven't liked the Maria Sanchez Show on Facebook, please do so because every morning we talk, give you a tease about what's going to be going on in the program. And yesterday we reported the story of the Chinese newborn that was trapped in a sewer pipe and caught on video over the weekend that became an international story yesterday. Well, they've announced that they believe they know the identity of the woman who gave birth to this baby, which, if you didn't hear about the story yet, the baby was caught in the sewer pipes, and folks heard a crying, so the firefighters came and cut the pipe, the L pipe where the baby was stuck, and rushed it to the hospital, where the hospital carefully, obviously, and gently cut and pulled the pipe apart, which was about 3 inches in diameter. And the baby is alive. I think one of the reasons is that the placenta was intact. So that would suggest that the baby was still getting its oxygen and its nutrients, although it was crying with that on it. But nevertheless, mostly unhurt. The baby weighed 6 pounds, 3 ounces, had a low heart rate, some minor abrasions on its head and limbs, and is being called baby number 9 for the number of the incubator that it's in the hospital. Again, outpouring of support from strangers who came to the hospital with diapers, baby clothes, powdered milk, and offers to adopt him. Apparently, they're being inundated with that. So the authorities have not released the name of the woman. They say that she's 22 years old, and they found baby toys and blood-stained toilet paper in her rented room in the building where the rescue occurred. She was present for the entire two-hour rescue, but did not admit giving birth until confronted by police. And this is as of this morning, they're saying that. It's not immediately clear if the mother is going to face criminal charges. The baby's mother told police she cleaned up the scene in the toilet after the delivery and that she managed to hide her pregnancy by wearing loose clothes and tightly wrapping her abdomen. She says she is a high school graduate who works at a restaurant. She became pregnant after a one-night stand with a man who later denied any responsibility, and she did not reveal the pregnancy to her parents. She could not afford an abortion, and so she secretly delivered the child Saturday afternoon in the toilet. This is her version. She said she tried to catch the baby, but he slipped into the sewer line, and that she alerted her landlord of the trapped baby after she could not pull the child out. That's so there's a little bit of conflict with the stories. Tonight begins the Scripps National Spelling Bee Face-Off. It's 281 spellers. They range in age from 8 to 14. They come from all 50 United States and the District of Columbia, U.S. territories, and Defense Department schools around the world, which means that some contestants are coming from the Bahamas, Canada, China, Ghana, Jamaica, Japan, and South Korea. This year marks a first. The Spelling Bee, National Spelling Bee, has been going since 1927. For the first time, they are requiring the spellers in preliminary and semifinal rounds to take a vocabulary test. So in other words, they can't just know how to spell the word, they have to know what the word means. So the competitors will advance to the semifinals and the finals based on their onstage spelling, as well as computer-based spelling and vocabulary questions. Vocabulary evaluations count for half of the speller's overall score. The Spelling Bee is taking place at the Gaylord National Resort and Convention Center in Oxon Hill, Maryland, outside Washington. The semifinals and finals will take place tomorrow, Thursday, and that competition is being broadcast by ESPN. The contestants range from third to eighth graders, with 116 speaking more than one language. The group is 52% girls and 48% boys. Two spellers have siblings who won the national title, so we've got legacies in there. And last year's winner was he's an eighth grader from San Diego. And here's an interesting factoid. Since 1999, 10 of the 14 winners have been Americans of Indian descent, including the last five. Well, as you know, if you're a regular listener to the program, and if you don't, we have a stable of correspondents that visit with our program when their field of expertise is in the news. One of them, which he's been with us for, I think, since 05. His name is Peter Sokolowski. He's the editor of Merriam-Webster.com. He visits with us every month. So like next week, he's visiting with us on Tuesday to talk about the last month's most searched words, how you say it, what they mean, and why. They get 1.5 billion hits a year. So we're talking about a lot of folks. So when he says that these are the most popular words of the month, it's like 100 million folks have been choosing those words. And they choose it for various reasons. Sometimes it's an important speech that a word gets used, or it's a phrase that was uttered by somebody who's famous or a celebrity or something, and then we all go, I wonder what that means. Ooh, nice word. So Peter, I was in contact with him this morning. He shared that he's going to be live tweeting color commentary from the Spelling Bee tomorrow night, that he gave a lecture Monday night to the spellers and their families, and he's signing autographs whenever he bumps into the folks in the hotel. So he's like a rock star for the word group of folks out there, which I just happen to love. I just think that's so cool that he's and he's a great guy. He's a Renaissance man. He's got such an interesting background. So don't miss his conversation with us on Tuesday and every month. We have, as I said, when it falls under their purview, then that's when they meet with us. And we have a couple that meet with us on scheduled. Peter is one of them. And then Kiki T, the world's only astrosexologist, she meets with us when the zodiac signs change. So we'll get to some more of the news in just a little bit. But now we're going to call Dr. James Levine. And as I mentioned, he's an endocrinologist at the Mayo Graduate School of Medicine.
Hi, this is James Levine.
Hello, Dr. Levine. This is Maria Sanchez. You're live on the Maria Sanchez Show. Good morning to you. Thank you for joining
us. Hi, Maria. How are you today?
I'm fabulous, and I'm so interested in hearing about our conversation because the quote that was in the news yesterday is from you, "The chair is out to kill us."
I believe it is, actually.
So can you give us a little bit of background? Because one of the things that I always look at when the certain stories hit the news is how much the folks were sampled. How many studies were there and how many participants and that sort of thing.
Maria, thank you. At this point in time, I would say 10 years ago, there were about a handful of studies pointing to sedentariness being critical in obesity, diabetes, poor blood pressure control, and so on. At this point in time, there are about cumulatively 10,000-20,000 different scientific papers all looking at different elements of this, from animal brain control all the way through to cancer epidemiology.
Wow.
And at this point in this has become sort of, you know, I have to tell you that when I started off doing this, I presented this information at a big scientific congress, and literally one of my colleagues got up and stood, ironically, in the corridor of this auditorium and screamed at me. I'm being absolutely serious, screamed at me right in the middle of this audience, saying, "This is the biggest load of irrelevance." And, you know, time has proven that to be incorrect. The data are now quite, I would very politely say, probably irrefutable at this point in time, that sitting is associated with, yes, low-calorie burn and obesity, predisposition to diabetes and poor blood sugar control, poor blood pressure control, certain types of malignancy in epidemiological studies, cardiovascular disease, low mood, and the converse to that is that walking programs consistently improve mood and help prevent depression. Sleep disorders. People sleep worse when they're very sedentary. And of course, the things that a lot of my patients directly relate to, stress. People feel stressed out nearly, a tremendous amount of the time. And so the health consequences of sitting all day long are at this point irrefutable, but more importantly, are literally chipping years off our lives, and perhaps even more importantly, that of our children in the next generation.
Now, one of the other quotes that was associated with the article that I discovered is that sitting is the new smoking.
Mm-hmm.
And talking about the more sedentary you are, that you're actually cutting minutes off of your lifespan.
The first part of the quote that sitting is more deleterious than smoking actually came out of the epidemiology unit from the Carolina universities. And I suppose when you think about it, it kind of makes sense because, if thankfully, as a physician, you know, still a minority of the population smoke. But of course, all of us, every single person listening to the show, sits. And many of us, many, many, many of us, I would say probably the majority of the audience, are sitting nearly all of the day long. So when you add it up, yes, indeed, sitting is actually causing more death than smoking. I don't look at the world quite that way, honestly. I'm a kind of a cup, 80% full all the time kind of guy.
Me too.
The way I look at the world is to say, well, the great thing, I mean, smoking, again, being serious, When you meet patients who have smoked for 20 or 30 years, quitting is actually very difficult. We all think it's easy if you're not a smoker, but it's actually very, very difficult. And then people have smoked for very deep reasons. The really cool thing about what we're trying to do is the realization is nearly everybody who's sitting all day long can get up for a significant proportion of that time. Therefore, this is amenable to millions and millions of people and can therefore save, if you like, many, many years of life. And again, more importantly to me, because when you talk to a patient about years of their life, I mean, you know, you can understand patients' eyes sort of, you know, fall downwards and look at their shoes, and it's a very miserable thought. You know, we're being perpetually reminded of one's mortality is, I think, quite upsetting. However, the way I look at it is to say, look, what the studies suggest is that if you can get people up and moving, you know, and we're not talking about going to the gym, we're talking about sort of intermittently, sporadically moving throughout the day, they are more productive at work, the data suggests, multiple studies now. Most importantly, people are happier, people feel brighter, they sleep better, and if one's a kid listening, because school's out, grades improve. And so, to me, the dividend is sort of a bit like a savings account, isn't it? The more you invest in getting up and moving, the return on that investment is substantive.
Now, does it help if you just stand rather than sit? Because I knew this boss once that he had a desk that was like a lectern. It was a podium, and he never sat during the day. He would stand there. That's where he'd take his notes. That's where he'd take his phone calls. He'd only sit on the couch when we would have meetings. Does that help also mitigate the damages of sitting?
Am I allowed a quick historical aside?
Oh, please do. We have time.
A little bit of history. So two other people had similar desks to that. One of them was, of course, Winston Churchill. That was just how his desk was. And another was actually Einstein. Einstein was originally a patent officer, and he insisted on doing all of his work at these standing lecterns. And by the way, it said that he came up with E equals MC squared on a cycling across the Princeton campus. You know. Anyway, so interestingly, when we first did all the studies suggested that people with obesity living in the same environment as people who are lean are prone to be seated 2.25 hours a day more than people who are lean. People who are lean are up and walking, and you'll hear where I'm going with this in a second, 2.25 hours a day more. So my way of thinking again was to say, look, it's the walking that's doing it. But very interestingly, and this was sort of my misconception, I thought therefore that if you just give people standing desks, it's not going to do anything. You know, people are just going to sort of stand and sort of, you know, find it a bit disconcerting. I proved to be wrong, it's sort of like being at home, isn't it? I'm wrong all the time. I tell you, at home, by definition, I'm wrong.
Yes.
Anyway, the great thing about science is there are data to substantiate that I'm wrong.
Yes.
Anyway, so but it's very interesting. So if you actually go, and these experiments have been done, if you go into a regular American office environment and you just give people standing desks, those individuals indeed use them, but very interestingly end up walking more. So it's kind of like if you get somebody onto their legs, they will inevitably move. And the data are actually very impressive in that regard. And it's important in that often standing desks are far less expensive than sitting ones, and many of them actually just clamp onto one's pre-existing structure. And so there's your answer. Oddly enough, standing, much like your previous boss, is actually bang on target.
Now, in those days, they didn't use the computer as often, but I guess you've got the tablets that you could put on a smaller workspace to do your internet connectivity.
Agree. And so, again, when we look at the experience, and we've now worked with sort of scores of companies, about sort of 65, 67 different companies. Again, if one reads and sort of thinks about all the video games and computers and internet shopping, whatever it may be, internet radio even, right?
<You know? laughs> No, but we're mobile. You can download to a tablet or to your iPhone and put your headphones in and take a walk.
Maria, that's exactly the point. And that's exactly how we feel about this in our programs, is these technologies actually give people mobility. So a perfect example, you're absolutely right. So a perfect example is listening to your show on the move. Podcast the show, pop it on your MP3 player, and off you go for a beautiful walk here in Arizona. It's a beautiful, beautiful day. Now, similarly, in the workplace, you might say, well, it's obviously different at work. It isn't. Conference calls. I've already done two this morning. One of them I did halfway up a mountain.
Really?
Yeah. Absolutely. And the programs we were discussing are like underserved Native American communities we work with. How can we make those opportunities better? You know, really, really cool stuff. But why couldn't I do it halfway up a mountain? And I would argue that I'm more focused, I'm not distracted, and again, that is the experience we find right across America. And those opportunities are even bigger than people realize. So one of our most sort of successful rollouts, everywhere we go we do this, and we've never had a complaint, is walk and talk meetings. So if you and I are having a meeting, as indeed we are, I feel as though you're in the room here right next to me, in fact, that there's no reason that meeting can't be done walk and talk. Now, you might say, well, how about note-taking? Very interestingly, and I'm sure none of your listeners will relate to this, most notes taken at meetings are never even read.
Really?
Yep.
So it's just busy work.
It's busy work. And my argument is people are taking notes to stay awake. And I've got to tell you my secret, but you mustn't tell anyone else.
Okay.
So everyone's got to sort of, you know, I need a cone of silence.
Turn their ears away.
Okay, everyone turn your ears off. Here's what I do. During meetings, I actually write poems.
Oh.
Because if I have to sit during a meeting, my mind just drifts away. If you have a walk and talk meeting, on the other hand, you have to be focused. And what's very interesting is, if you can't remember what you're supposed to do at the end of a meeting, in other words, my task is to do such and such, then it hasn't been a very effective meeting. And so, oddly enough, all of this sort of mobile work, whether it's mobile school, mobile, whatever it may be, and therefore you can understand why it's more productive, because people are sort of more turned on, they're brighter, and they're healthier, great, but most importantly, they sort of do better work.
Now, Dr. Levine, is there a goal that we're supposed to know about? Like, you sit X, therefore you should stand / walks X so that it's balanced, or one-third, two-thirds, or is there something to aspire to in terms of getting to the ideal benefit level?
Marie, my feeling on this is, and again, one has to look at the data as a whole, and one has to, in the back of my mind is, if I'm trying to work in a real corporation and I say to everybody, look, I want everybody up half an hour of every hour, there's going to be no American workplace that's going to let me do that, rightly so, right? Too much. So here's what I say. 10 minutes every hour, you should be able to convert either instead of emailing the accountants on the fourth floor, walk down to the accountants on the fourth floor and get the job done on foot. If you've got a meeting scheduled at 2 o'clock, just say, look, why don't we do half the meeting walking, just see how it goes, and then we'll, you know, if it doesn't work out, we'll just use the office. And so what I say is 10 minutes out of every hour, and you might say, well, where's the science behind that? Well, if you actually sort of add up the average workday, that is bang on that requisite of trying to slot in 2.25 hours of extra walking a day. And my point is, when companies buy into this, and this happens, and Maria, what's very interesting is it is happening in multiple quite dynamic companies, then certainly, we've never seen productivity fall off, and on average, productivity improves somewhere between 7 to 11%.
Now, along those lines, I was with the American Red Cross doing communications several years ago, and at one point, they declared the building that I was in that every Friday, you couldn't email or make a phone call; you had to go to the offices of the person to whom you needed to communicate.
Marie, how did that work?
It did.
Did it work?
Yeah, but there was great reluctance initially because it's like, what a waste of time. All I have to do is pick up the phone. You know, this is going to take me 5 minutes or seven or wherever they were going. But it also got people to be bumping into one another in the hallways and to be socializing and interacting instead of everyone staying in their office.
So here's my we've done no email days, and actually for some reason everyone always picks on Friday. I don't know what it is about Friday. I suppose we're all sort of fed up with what the guys end. Interestingly, I will tell you that in some companies it does work. That's actually why I was very interested to know what you said. What our experience is, after about 3 to 6 months of that kind of thing, it generally wanes off. People just don't sort of keep that momentum going. In other words, it's an example, and I'm not saying, you know, some companies who totally buy into that, and I've worked with companies who've got dogs so that people can, you know, go and walk the dog from time to time. That is a genius move, by the way.
To be able to bring your pet to work?
No. They actually have an office dog.
Oh, an office dog. Oh.
Yeah. It is the most amazing thing when you actually see it in action. Anyway, so So some companies will take on a big thing like, you know, no email Fridays. But what you'll find is it actually, in many companies, not necessarily this one, that actually doesn't work because, you know, so much of our professional communication is email. And once I'm emailing, you know, Bob Smith, you know, in Cleveland,
right,
you know, and I'm copying Jill Saunders in my company, mm-hmm, these are all made up names, by the way, then, you know, I might as well email Jill at the same time to say, what did you think of my email? And all of a sudden, we're emailing each
right,
other.
But, right.
So that's why those things, in our experience, aren't as successful as sort of saying, you know what, you know, every time, you know, we're going to have a... So here's a great example of something that's very successful. Many companies use Outlook to do their meetings. So what we say is, look, every time you have a walk and talk meeting, color-code it green. Then what we do is we get the IT department to sort of scan the whole Outlook enterprise so that different management groups can have competitions. And the group that does the most walk and talk meetings, mm, the greenest group, mm-hmm, if you like, win some kind of, you know, extra, you know, day on the beach or whatever, you know, whatever it may be. Day at the art gallery actually is a popular winning thing, or party or something.
Right.
And taking that as an example, there are lots of different things. We've had Office Olympics. We've got a sort of a thing where people send pieces of string around the office. That's quite a laugh, actually. But the sense you get from this, and including the example you gave, is what's really important about this is it generates a sense of fun.
Right.
And the trick to all of this, and in fact, the trick to individualized programs is to engage individual creativity.
Now, what do you do yourself? Because I read that you have a treadmill at your desk.
Well, I suppose you don't realize, but I'm actually talking to you from a treadmill. I mean, I'll hold the phone down to the treadmill so you can hear it. Here you go.
So
there you go.
Yeah.
I'm on a treadmill as we speak, moving at 1.3 miles an hour. And in a way, you know, I'm at work. I mean, this is sort of my job. And what one realizes just from that is that I'm obviously doing exactly the same job as I would have done. I could have done our interview sitting down on a chair with my feet up, drinking whatever it may be.
Right.
You know, right?
Right.
But instead, I'm here with a lovely, you know, thing of water. I'm on a treadmill. I'm looking out. I've got a beautiful trees outside my window, and I'm achieving exactly the same amount. And bluntly, I would hope that it's sort of even better than it might have been if I was sort of lounging in a chair.
You could suggest that because you're being active, that, well, there is energy in your voice, certainly. You've definitely have, your personality is bright and clear coming through, which is refreshing.
Sweet.
It's too, but I also hear that there's furniture, like there is furniture for ergonomics, but there's also furniture that helps with active sitting.
That helps with, yeah. So it's actually very interesting. Around the 1940s, around there, there was a tremendous investment. Listen to this. This is very interesting, actually. There was a tremendous investment from the scientific community in trying to work out how people could do as much as possible and move as little as possible. I call it sort of the Homer Simpson console, right? So the idea was that one would not need to move at all during a day, and yet with a flick of, remember, computers weren't available then, but with a flick of a switch, one could call a meeting. With a flick of another switch, one could send something down to the transcription pool. You could use these vacuum tubes to move documents around. So the idea was there was a science to stop people moving because it was believed that way people could be more productive the less they move. And think about conveyor belts, and that was the whole era where they were being developed, mm-hmm, to stop people moving around factories, that sort of the car went through the conveyor system. So bearing that in mind, at the back end of that joke, you'll see where the joke is in a second, a whole another science followed, which was sort of the science of how to help people who are now in agony because they were getting back problems, leg problems, deep vein thrombosis, feeling awful, wrist problems, carpal tunnel, all this and that. And that's where the field of ergonomics really came into the forefront, whereas we could design desks, we can design chairs to, you know, keep people sitting down for 12 hours a day without noticing, mm-hmm, it, so that they could operate the Homer Simpson console. Now, interestingly, I very reluctantly, I have to tell you, agreed to give a talk at the National Ergonomics Conference because I figured people would start throwing stuff at me, possibly donuts. But that didn't happen at all. Now there is a sort of a convergence of opinion in the ergonomics community, too, that this type of of course it's not uniform, but as I said, no one threw anything at me, so therefore I view that as, you know, we're moving in the right direction.
Uh-huh.
You know, so, but there's a convergence of opinion in the ergonomics community that actually getting up and helping people move not only is sort of good for all these health things I mentioned, but also helps prevent back problems, help prevent leg problems, and actually we haven't seen, you might have thought there'd be wrist problems using, you know, computers whilst, that doesn't happen either. And so, you know, ergonomics folk have joined the movement, so to speak. And that's actually very, very important because that whole ergonomics community are beautifully skilled at thinking about, well, what height should the video screen be at? You know, those console development technician science, if you like, is very helpful to us for building very effective walking, dynamic, healthy workplaces.
Excellent. That's so great. Thank you so much for your time and for your passion. I appreciate it.
You kidding? It was such a pleasure. Anytime.
Well, you're a sweetheart, and we really do appreciate you. So thank you so much.
It's a pleasure.
Take care. Dr. James Levine, he's an endocrinologist at the Mayo Graduate School of Medicine. He's presently at the campus in Arizona, as he mentioned. And what an adorable person. So the information came out yesterday, and I thought, we can share it with you, but let's just go to the horse's mouth about the man who's behind it and get his, you know, opinion and science behind it, which I totally appreciate. So if you have something that you'd like to know more about or you'd like us to follow through on it, please do not hesitate to contact. You can reach me on the website, and you can find how to, it's all there, my emails and even my phone number is there. So now we're going to call our next guest, who is the spokesperson for the National Foundation for Celiac Awareness, and she's going to be visiting with us about...
Thank you for calling the NFCA. National.
There we go. See, it's live raw radio, and you get it right behind the scenes.
Cheryl McAvoy.
Hi, Cheryl. Good morning. This is Maria Sanchez. You're live and on the air, The Maria Sanchez Show. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Hi, Maria. Thank you so much for having us on today.
You're welcome. And May isn't done yet, so we're still topical in that May is also Celiac Awareness Month. And can you speak with us, Cheryl, first in general about the National Foundation for Celiac Awareness, and then we can get into the specifics of what celiac is, how you might be diagnosed with it, what might be some of the signs that you might be somebody who has it, and what you can do about it.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So first of all, the National Foundation for Celiac Awareness, we are a national nonprofit that's focused on helping individuals who have celiac disease or another gluten-related disorder. So we focus on increasing diagnoses as well as improving the quality of life for those who are on a lifelong gluten-free diet.
Now, there are folks that are choosing to be gluten-free and don't necessarily have the disease. Do you know what the reason or the rationale behind that is?
Yes, that's correct. So we have seen quite an increase, especially in recent years, of individuals who are on a gluten-free diet. Actually, one of the latest studies that I've seen is that about 30% of Americans are either eliminating gluten from their diet or say they're trying to cut down on it. That's for a variety of reasons. So everything from there are a lot of celebrities who are talking about the gluten-free diet, so it's received what we kind of call a health halo effect, where people assume that gluten-free food is healthier, which gluten-free food can be very healthy, but it also can be, there certainly is a lot of gluten-free junk food out there as well. But it also is a lot of people are realizing that they feel better on a gluten-free diet. So, for example, in previous years, 10 years ago, celiac disease awareness wasn't even that much information out there about celiac disease. But now with the increasing awareness about celiac disease and, working with researchers and finding out more about it, we're discovering that there are other conditions. Now there's a condition known as non-celiac gluten sensitivity, which is has very similar symptoms to celiac disease, but does not have the intestinal damage, which I'll explain celiac disease in a little bit, doesn't have the intestinal damage that's seen in celiac disease. So it's kind of a reaching a larger spectrum of people who do need to be on a gluten-free diet. So I think that's also why so many people are adopting a gluten-free diet as well, because they have some of those other health conditions that benefit from a gluten-free diet.
Cheryl, what is gluten?
Gluten is a protein found in wheat, barley, and rye. So when you think about pasta, pizza, cookies, cake, any of those types of bread, doughy products are going to contain gluten. But the surprising thing about gluten, though, that a lot of people don't realize is that it's found in products that are not just baked goods. You know, gluten can be found in soy sauce. It can be found in lunch meats. It can be found in licorice. So that's where when somebody has celiac disease or gluten sensitivity and needs to be on a gluten-free diet, you know, not just because they're trying to lose weight, but because they need it for medical necessity, that's where it can get a little challenging because, you know, it's hard to sometimes to find out where that gluten may be hiding.
But and now more than ever, it seems that there are a wide array of opportunities for choices, selections, and labeling. I mean, because my eldest son is dating a woman who has been diagnosed with celiac disease, and that's how it came on my radar. And then here it is May, and it's like, oh, okay, perfect.
Right.
But I've had her for dinner a couple times, and so I'm just, you know, I don't want to be responsible for the one that gets her sick, right? So I got to make sure it says gluten-free or, you know, whatever on it, even if it's a tortilla or that sort of thing. And I'm amazed at how many choices there are.
Yes, yes, absolutely. So the gluten-free market is now about a $4.2 billion industry. So there certainly are a lot more gluten-free foods available, and manufacturers are taking more of an initiative to label their products gluten-free. And that's also, you know, we have see some products that are gluten-free alternatives that are coming out, like, you know, gluten-free pasta, for example. But there's also certain products like potato chips that have always been gluten-free, but now the manufacturers are actually testing the products to verify that they are, in fact, gluten-free and that they're putting that label on the package. The one thing I will say, though, is we currently don't have federal regulations for gluten-free labeling. So when you have something like allergen labeling, like milk, or wheat, actually, that does need to be labeled on a package, but there are actually no regulations currently for gluten. So that can cause some confusion, especially for consumers. So we're hoping to have a final rule on gluten-free labeling sometime in the very near future. But until that happens, we know that, you know, there's really no regulation on that, so it can cause a bit of a challenge.
So you're suggesting that if somebody labels it gluten-free, it might not indeed actually be gluten-free?
Well, we always encourage best practices. So, for example, if a product is labeled gluten-free but seems to have, a product or an ingredient that may seem questionable or you're not quite sure, we always encourage people to call the manufacturer and talk to them about the practices that they use in their facility. But certainly we always hope that the manufacturers are keeping their consumers' best health and interests in mind and are testing products, verifying to make sure that they're gluten-free, but currently there is no requirement to do so. It's all voluntary as far as labeling.
So describe what the symptoms of celiac disease are like and how it manifests itself.
Sure. So celiac disease, basically when a person who has celiac disease ingests gluten, so they eat a piece of bread or a bite of pizza, that's going to cause an immune reaction. It's actually an immune disease, an autoimmune disease. So some of the symptoms that are more immediate that may happen, and they can, you know, onset sometime in, you know, in a few hours or a day, and they can last for several days or even weeks. They can be stomach aches, headaches, joint pain, fatigue. We see a lot of cases of people who have anemia and don't know why, and that's because of celiac disease. So there's actually about 300 different types of symptoms, and making things even more difficult is the fact that some people have no outward symptoms at all. So it can be very challenging for doctors and for patients to be able to pinpoint the fact that celiac disease may be a problem for them. So there are a number of symptoms. And then when you get to long-term effects, so if celiac disease goes undiagnosed and untreated, and at the moment about 83% of people who have celiac disease are undiagnosed.
Aye,
so they do not know that they have it and they're not being treated properly. It can lead to things like infertility, osteoporosis, thyroid disease, and even some types of cancer. So it is a very...
Hello? I think we lost her. We'll call her back. There we go. So did you hear those numbers that she just mentioned? Because they were staggering in terms of 83% are undiagnosed. 30% of people are removing gluten from their diet. I mean, it's just crazy that to think that it's affecting these people this much. And if you don't know it, then the consequences of it going untreated.
Thank you for calling the NFC.
There we go. Wow. I'm wheat, barley, and rye are what is gluten. And it's an autoimmune disease. Maybe we're having trouble here. I'll try her again. You're probably impressed that if you've started listening early on that I actually figured out how to use the system here. And I prefer to call our guests because I never know what the timing is going to be with our other stories.
Thank you for calling the NFPA.
There we go. And Cheryl McAvoy is who's visiting with us. She's a spokesperson for the National Foundation for Celiac Awareness. Maybe it's their system. I guess I'll hang up. So maybe, I don't know if I gave her the number for the studio because of me calling them, the guests. I'll try one more time being the optimist here. Oh, I know. I'll call operator. How about?
Thank you for calling the NFC.
Maybe they can connect me if it connects.
Thank you very much for calling the National Foundation for Celiac Awareness. You've reached the desk of Rachel Borowski, office manager. I'm unavailable at this time to receive your...
Okay. So we get to discuss news then. So anyway, sorry for that. But again, I think we got a lot of good news out of that, that there is not only celiac disease, but there's non-celiac gluten sensitivity. And a gluten, again, is wheat, barley, and rye. Fatigue, anemia, 300 other symptoms, 83% undiagnosed. So if you think that the next question I was going to ask her was, how do you get diagnosed? I would imagine it's a blood test. So yesterday, the governor of Colorado, John Hickenlooper, signed into law measures to regulate the recreational use of marijuana in Colorado, including blood level limits for drivers. They also set up a voter referendum to impose a tax on the non-medical sale of cannabis, which the referendum will be in November, and they would like to impose a 15% excise tax and an additional 10% sales tax on marijuana sales. They set blood limits for driving while under the influence of marijuana at 5 nanograms per milliliter and limiting purchases of marijuana to non-Colorado residents at 1/4 of an ounce. So also voters in Washington State approved legalizing recreational marijuana use last November. What Colorado did is they approved it, and then they needed it to be made into law. So there were bills that were introduced, and then the governor signed them into law yesterday. Colorado and Washington are among 20 states and the District of Columbia that allow the use of medical marijuana. And in Washington State, the Liquor Control Board is the one that establishes the regulations. And earlier this month, they set a draft rules and said that marijuana must be grown indoors, tested for contaminants and potency. Licensed to grow, process, and sell the drug would each cost $1,000 per year on top of a $250 application fee under the proposed guidelines. That's for Washington State. So the way I feel about marijuana is that if we would regulate it and we would tax it, we would, one, destroy the Mexican cartels that are involved with the illegal importation of it and all of that crime that is involved with that. Two, the tax revenue would benefit our country, our governments, our states. And three, there wouldn't be a hit or miss in terms of potency because it would be regulated. So in Colorado, they have to grow it indoors. They have to watch the smell. If you have a license, you can grow 12 pot plants. If you don't, you can grow 6. So to me, it just takes the crime out of it, and let's get the revenue. So less than 2 weeks after Angelina Jolie described her decision to have a double mastectomy to avoid breast cancer, her aunt died of the disease in Escondido, California over the weekend. She was 61 years old. Her name is Debbie Martin. She is the younger sister of Angelina Jolie's mother, Marceline Bertrand, who died of ovarian cancer in 2007. So Ron Martin, who is Debbie Martin's husband, confirmed to AP that she had the BRCA1 gene, but was not aware of it until after her 2004 cancer diagnosis. And his quote is, "Had we known, we certainly would have done exactly what Angelina did." So imagine the loss, and imagine how much that validates and justifies her decision for her elective double mastectomy reconstructive surgery. And I was with my folks over the weekend, and my mom had her right breast removed. It'll be 6 years next month, and she's had nothing but problems and complications. And if anything could go wrong, it has gone wrong, and it's literally destroyed her quality of life and taken from us the woman that she once was. And so I said to her, "Could you get tested for that BRCA1? Because I'd like to know, and I know my sister would like to know, that if you've got it, then we need to look further into it. And if you don't have it, then it's just one less thing that we have to concern ourselves with." And she said she went last week. She had blood tests done because she's going to this pain management doctor. And she was all set to ask about the BRCA1 gene test, and her blood work was horribly wrong. It just, she's a medical technologist, so she knows things that I don't know, that maybe you don't know about blood and numbers and all that stuff. And her white blood count was this and this and that. And it's like, okay, so she was so rattled, she took the test again the next day, and the numbers were even worse. So she's dealing with that. So there is an organization called the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, and they have something known as a Better Life Index. And every year they survey and they announce what is the world's happiest industrialized nation. So late yesterday they announced the results, and Australia has been named the world's happiest industrialized nation for the third year running. And it's based on criteria that includes satisfaction, like happiness with life, work-life balance, income, and housing. So they call Australia the lucky country, which beat out Sweden in 2 and Canada in 3. Now, I had the privilege and the pleasure of being in Australia for the first time last fall. My daughter and I took a trip, and we ended up in Australia. We were at Darwin, Brisbane, and Auckland. And then we spent another couple days there before we came home. And yes, it's a fabulous place, and it's beautiful, and it's newer. And I couldn't help get over the fact that this entire country was founded by felons, basically. So when the UK especially, but other countries, had the worst of the worst of the worst offenders, they shipped them to Australia just to get rid of them, to get them out of their penal system, to not ever see them again, men and women. And so those folks then that were the worst of the worst of the worst in terms of their criminal and heinous acts procreated and now are the forefathers and mothers of this country that we know to be us, Australia. So I call that dubious in their origins, and there are still the manifests of who came over that you can trace back. Some restaurants have them hanging on the walls that you can trace back, because it hasn't been that long, if you are directly a descendant of somebody who came and was shipped over there. And their cost of living is, they have an affordability for them, but not for us. That regular cocktails, like like a gin and tonic, say, or a vodka tonic, not a call brand, just their house, was $18, which is about $23. So I looked at my daughter and I was like, I'm not spending $50 on two cocktails. There's no way. So I don't know how they live. I know that they have an average, higher average cost of living. So here, they say Australia has remained largely immune from the global financial crisis. Its economy has been growing on average 3.5% over the last 20 years. The economy has strong demand from Asia and China, and its financial sector has been robust, and they haven't had the global downturn that much of the rest of the world has. Australia's employment levels are at 73% of folks aged 15 to 64, and that's above the Organization for Economic Cooperation Development's average, which is 66%. And their average household disposable income sits at $28,884, and that's more than the average, despite the fact that Australians work an average of 83 hours less a year. So life expectancy is 2 years higher than the OECD average, and satisfaction, excuse me, is 4% higher than the global average. So in the report, the organization says Australians felt a strong sense of community and high levels of civic participation, with 94% of people feeling like they knew someone to rely on should they need help. So they use 11 criteria. It includes housing, education, health, income, civic engagement, work-life balance, income, satisfaction. So civic engagement is something interesting because there's folks there that get involved. I'm a huge believer in make a difference, make this world a better place, roll up your sleeves, help when you can, how you can. And it's not just about money. It can be about time. It can be about your field of expertise. It can be about mentoring. It can be about, you know, helping the gardens. It can be any one of those things. So the cool thing is, though, at least in the United States, if you're an American, was in the top 10. Aside from Australia, Sweden, and Canada, in order, the top 10 is Norway, Switzerland, United States, Denmark, Netherlands, Iceland, and the United Kingdom. So we mentioned yesterday that on our visit to see my folks in San Diego over the weekend, that I asked them if they wouldn't mind watching Steven Soderbergh's HBO movie, Behind the Candelabra. And my folks are game. They were willing. So it debuted, premiered, if you will, on Sunday night at 9 o'clock. And they had two broadcasts that I didn't know. And the next one was at 11 o'clock. If you haven't seen it, I strongly recommend it. I think it's fabulous. I remember Liberace. I was little. And my grandmother just loved him. And I guess a lot of people did, because he was the world's most famous performer for decades. So the Behind the Candelabra was watched by 2.4 million viewers on the Sunday at 9 o'clock viewing only. That's the most viewers of an HBO original movie premiere since 2.6 million watched Something the Lord Made, which was in May of 2004. So across the two plays on Sunday, the Behind the Candelabra had a total of 3.5 million viewers. So for Hollywood, who turned down the opportunity to make the movie because they said it was too gay and they didn't think there was a market, obviously they would have been happy with that. So it's based on Scott Thorson's 1988 memoir, who is played by Matt Damon, and Michael Douglas plays the star of Liberace. It also featured Dan Aykroyd, who I didn't recognize ever in the movie, Scott Bakula, who I also, Scott Bakula played one of the side characters. Now that they mention it, I see it. And Rob Lowe. He played the plastic surgeon that did all kinds of things on them. Interestingly enough, though, the film is going to be released theatrically in the UK next month on June 7th, so they're not going to let you watch it on TV. Now, we spoke last week with a professor from Cal State University, Channel Islands, who took 20 students to Cuba on a cultural tour. They were going to be there about 9 nights, I believe, if my recollection serves me correct. You can get the information off of our website, by the way, who was on the program, their contact information, and the content of that day's podcast. And they were going to do all kinds of cultural stuff. And I went 2 years ago also on a philanthropic cultural exchange that was sanctioned through the U.S. Department of Treasury. But Cuba announced yesterday that they're expanding their public internet access with more than 100 new cyber salons across the island. A home web service is greatly restricted. According to the government, only 2.9% of Cubans said they had access to the World Wide Web. 2.9, imagine that. So starting June 4th, people can sign up with the state telecom ETESA for temporary or permanent accounts to use one of the 118 centers. The price tag is going to be $4.50 an hour for the use of the internet salon, which you might think sounds reasonable. Well, not there, because the state salaries average about $20 per month. Plus, of course, they get subsidized goods and services. So it's created a little bit of controversy. Folks have been weighing in. And one quote from somebody who gave the name Osvaldo Ulloa, it's a real bargain. I mean, I work for a week and then I can get online for an hour. Fabulous. So they say some sites are censored. It's going to be censored, of course, like just like China. And it's not clear whether the new service will block pages that are not deemed viable. So they're limping along, and that's what the professor and I spoke about, because when I was there, it's as if time stood still. The cars are 50 years old with now Japanese motors or engines in them. There's the old Chevys that you see going down the roads. I had the opportunity to visit Ernest Hemingway's home there that was really fabulous, where he wrote most his most prolific things. And then I saw the biopic Hemingway, and I didn't realize how tortured. Obviously, a man who kills himself is going to be tortured. And the other big story in the news today is a record 40% of all households, this is in America, with children under the age of 18 include mothers who are either the sole or primary source of income for the family. This is according to a new Pew Research Center analysis of data from the U.S. Census Bureau. The share was just 11% in 1960. So we've gone from 11 to 40%. Now, it's not just that 40% isn't single mothers. It's single mothers and women who are the primary source of income for the family. And they're calling these breadwinner moms. And they're made up of two very different groups. 37% are married mothers who have a higher income level than their husbands, and 63% are single mothers. So the other disparity between the two groups is that the median family income of the married mothers who are with their husbands was $80,000. And if the median for families with children with a single mother is $23,000. And then this also goes across ethnic lines as well. So they're saying, and it's funny that I won't go through all the responses to the polls about what we find troubling on the topic of single mothers. 64% of Americans say that this growing trend is a big problem, but 71% thought it was a problem in 2007, so that's gone down. 4 in 10 adults under the age of 30 view it as a big problem, compared with 65% in their 30s and 40s and 74% of adults who are 50 and older. And you know, ideally, being a divorced single mom for many years, that was probably my greatest sorrow, was that I was raising my 4 children in a household that had to deal with visitation, with custody, with primary physical custody, with holidays, with their 2 parents not under the same roof. I believe that that's ideal. But sometimes stuff happens. And it did in my case, and my children were 2, 4, 6, and 8 when their father and I divorced. And I was doing radio in Los Angeles and leaving our home at 3 a.m. because I was producing when I first started morning radio team here in Los Angeles. So obviously, of course, I had to have an au pair to help me to get the kids up in the morning, to feed them breakfast, to make their lunches. And then I hired a college student to come and pick them up and take them to school. And then I, because of my early hours, I was able to go and pick them up from school and bring them home and do homework and practices and dinner and bedtime and baths and all that sort of stuff. So it certainly wasn't ideal, and it wasn't what I envisioned. My folks have been married for 58 years, but it was what it was. So in fact, I even have a girlfriend who is 6 months pregnant and not married, and by choice. She said that she felt like her life was passing her by. Her first marriage didn't work. They didn't have children. So she said, you know, I just thought, I'm getting older. I've always wanted to be a mother. And she went and got inseminated. And she's having the child on her own, and she's going to raise it on her own. And then hopefully, fortunately, somebody will step into her life and, you know, agree to parent or partner or whatever. But if not, she's not counting on that. And I can't blame her for that either. I knew from the time I figured out that I didn't want to be a nun, which was about at the age of 10 or 12, that I was going to be a wife and mother. And so I just
thank you for listening to the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com. Live every weekday morning, 9 a.m. Pacific, and on the net at LATalkRadio.com and MariaSanchezShow.com.